All right. Good afternoon, my friends. I hope you're doing well. Stefan Molyneux from Free Domain. And I have a little bit of time this afternoon. A call slot failed to materialize, so I wanted to chat a little bit and talk to you guys, have questions, comments, issues, challenges, problems, criticisms, whatever is on your mind. The Trump administration has recently changed rules so that people who are on some kind of temporary visa or accommodation in America, and I'm not an expert, obviously look it up yourself, but they, if they want a green card, they have to go back to their country of origin in order to wait for their green card, which can, of course, take some time. And, of course, quite predictably, the caterwauling about immigration has arisen in that people are saying, oh, but there are all these skilled people who are adding to the GDP. They're going to have to leave the country. All these AI workers are going to have to leave the country. And it's the worst thing ever. And tearing families apart. And all of this just emotional claptrap, utter bullshit. Who cares? Total nonsense. Now, I, of course, am not an American. I think I can speak with some minor authority with regards to the perspectives and opinions of the friendly cannibals down south. But I think these sentiments are shared by a lot of Americans. And the idea that people need to be in America to produce value for Americans is kind of odd. Because one of the things that kind of subtly happened as a result of COVID was everyone was told, oh yeah, you can just work remotely and that's totally fine. Now, it doesn't matter if you're down the street in another state or in another country. You can still provide and add value. So if there are all these AI workers and everybody was told for years that they could work remotely, no problem, in fact, it was fine, then the idea that you have to be in America physically in order to provide value to the American economy is just not believed anymore. It's just not believed anymore. And the idea that you would sell off the historical continuity of your entire culture and history for the sake of a point or two of GDP growth is frankly completely and totally demonic. Completely and totally demonic. Well, you have to accept infinity immigrants because otherwise you might not make as much money. I mean, maybe I'm a little unusual this way. I think people are kind of coming around to this position. But who cares that much about money? Who cares? And we can say, ah, yes, but the immigrants are so good for the economy in America. Maybe. There's, let's just say, somewhat conflicting data on that. Because when you get immigrants, oftentimes you will get their elderly parents who then hoover up healthcare resources while having never paid into the system, and so on. So that's not entirely positive. And I had a friend who used to work in an American hospital. And one of the huge issues, not obviously dealt about much in the pit, but one of the major issues is multilingualism, that you need to have access to 50 to 75 or 100 translators in order to provide healthcare. And of course, it's pretty unfair to the descendants of people who founded America to say, well, in order to get a job as a teenager, you have to speak Spanish. It's not particularly ideal. The sort of society hurtling towards press 9 for English is not what many people would consider a shining, virtuous ideal of progress. And of course, since America reopened the floodgates of immigration, which were largely shut from 1925 to 1965, 1965 plus, well, if immigration is so fantastic for the American economy, why has the national debt kept growing and growing? Why are the unfunded liabilities cruising around 200, not billion, my friends, but trillion dollars, completely incomprehensible sum? And why, what is it, 40 trillion now, the national debt? So if immigration has exploded and roughly on par, so has unfunded liabilities and the national debt also exploded, then how can this be considered a universal positive? And people just saying stuff, high-skilled immigrants are really great for the American economy, is, well, people look around. What's happened to the economy? What's happened to the price of everything? I mean, has the American economy benefited as much from immigration as immigration cost it in terms of COVID? And if you didn't have any travel between countries, you wouldn't have had COVID. COVID cost how many trillions of dollars? We don't know, because the debts are still being paid. I mean, if you had a very strict come-to-the-country policy involving quarantines, you wouldn't have had COVID in America, right? And this can all be done, and done pretty easily. And there's an account on X called I/O, which posts some interesting demographic and IQ information. But either this person isn't a white male, or doesn't know any white males, or certainly has no sympathy for the plight of white males. But people are getting a little bit tired of two things in America. Number one, ethnic in-group hiring preferences. And number two, the fact that there are almost insurmountable legal barriers to hiring white males. Kind of annoying in America, largely built by white males, that white males can barely get any jobs anymore. The vast majority, the overwhelming majority of jobs over the last 5 to 10 years have gone to women and immigrants who are not white males. And so this account on X was posting, when somebody said we don't want high-skilled immigration either, it was posting like, oh, that's totally insecure, you just can't compete, blah, blah, blah. Which is kind of like saying, in some ways, it's a bit hyperbole, but not totally, it's kind of like saying to the blacks under Jim Crow, well, you just can't compete. It's like, well, you know that there are some significant legal barriers to competing, right? So saying that white males are only concerned about immigration because they're too insecure to compete with the immigrants, well, it is completely overstepping the fact that white males, to a large degree in America, are utterly shut out of the hiring market. Now, this is because there's disparate impact. Lawsuits, the DOJ might go after companies that they perceive to have been not promoting enough diversity, and it's a very fuzzy, you don't know if you're in compliance or not as a whole. And also, there are set-asides and artificial boosts to companies headed by anybody other than white males. There are even preferential loans to buy houses for people who are not white males. And, I mean, unfortunately for people, I've had a disco ball career. It has had many facets, to put it mildly. And I worked in HR for years, in summers, full-time, other times part-time. I worked in HR for years for a major HR department of a major corporation. Well, first of all, they do no work. I mean, it's ridiculous, number one. And if they do have work to do, they hire consultants to do it, or they hire temps to do it. I did this in the government, and I did this in HR. And the hostility towards white males, straight white males in particular, in HR, is truly a force to be seen and reckoned with. It radicalized me to, or not radicalized me, but brought me to the actual facts and truth of the matters of the world. I mean, remember one woman in HR whose family was from India, and she was flipping through the pages of Canada's national newspaper and looking at the board appointees, and she said with contempt in her lips, it might just all just be the same picture of the same guy over and over. Just this hostility. Anger. There's anger. And it's pretty hard. You know, they've sent out resumes with male names on them, resumes with females on them. The female names get many, many multiples the number of responses. And there was an engineer who changed his name from, I think he was in America, who changed his name from a white name to an Indian name and got immediate callbacks and so on. So there are just a lot of barriers. And of course, there are these roving bands of ethnic groups that are constantly scanning companies to see if there's anything, any club they can swing to call them racists. And so in defense, in an understandable way, there's an intense set of legal barriers against hiring white males. Very real, very substantial, and very embedded. And then this D-bag of a X account is like, well, but it's just because the white males can't compete, you see. And he didn't say white males, but, you know, everybody knows what we're talking about here. Well, it's just because people who are concerned about immigration just can't compete in an open playing field. I mean, and it just takes a moment's thought, right? Of course, there's an open playing field. You can hire anyone from anywhere. You can hire people from India. You can hire people from Thailand. You can hire people overseas. So everyone's already competing with the world. I mean, and this is someone who just does not understand the legal barriers, the legal disincentives to hiring white males. I mean, even if you boot up your iOS store or your Android store, you see spotlight on indigenous indie game developers, preferential loans, preferential mortgages, massive subsidies to everyone except white males. And, you know, you can like this, you can not like this, whatever. I think it's bad to do these sorts of things as a whole. But to pretend it's not real is jaw-droppingly, well, I don't know. He's not a stupid guy. I don't know if it's a guy. I think it's a guy. He's not a stupid guy. It's just unbelievably bigoted. Just unbelievably bigoted. And then, you know, the guy replies to me and I said, look, you don't know anything about this because these are the issues. And he's like, you're cringe, you're embarrassing, blah, 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 right? It's not an argument, of course, which is kind of sad. And, you know, he says, oh, you have such a shallow understanding of these issues. Yeah, bro, I worked in HR for years. I know. I've seen it up close more than just about anybody has who's willing to talk about it. And as far as, you know, the IQ stuff, I interviewed 17 of the world's renowned experts on IQ for many, many, many hours, read their books, their papers, blah, 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 blah. I'm pretty good at that stuff. I don't think he's interviewed 17 world's renowned experts on human intelligence or anything like that. So when somebody who's a white male said, we don't want high-skilled immigration, this IO fellow said, it's almost impossible to view these people as anything other than insecure, downwardly mobile losers afraid of competition from more talented immigrants. And then I wrote back and said, immigrants tend to hire their own. Almost no new jobs go to white males due to diversity quotas. You know nothing. And then he wrote, you're embarrassing. You're cringe. You congratulate yourself. Congratulate yourself as someone who knows the data on immigration and who knows the science on IQ, but you demonstrate very little statistical or scientific competence on either subject. So, now, of course, it is true that white male unemployment is not super high, but the abandonment of the workforce or the hiding out in academia and so on, or, you know, going to get additional degrees or NEET, right, not in education, employment, or training, is pretty significant. So, just the idea that you would potentially trade in the cultural and historical legacy and momentum of your entire country for the sake of potentially some economic growth. Life is not about economic growth, right? It's like saying to people, well, you know, you're going to have more money if you don't have children. You just give up on 4 billion years of an unbroken line of survival and flourishing and fighting and reproducing and raising, because you can go to Thailand and you can have some Vietnamese coffee and you can go and see the cherry blossoms in Japan. It's like, that's just seeing stuff. You're not creating, you're not producing, you're not adding to the beauty of the world. You're just looking at shite, just looking at stuff. I'm not a participant. I am not a creator. I am an observer, right? The old thing used to be, Veni, Viti, Vici. I came, I saw, I conquered. Now it's just, I came, I saw, I went home, and I made a couple of scrapbooks, which were then thrown out by my Dominican cleaners 3 business days after I died. And nobody remembered my name 4 business days after that. The idea that you can give up that which is of treasure in your life for the sake of a couple of extra bucks. I mean, this is all the way back to Satan's offer to Jesus in the wilderness. Follow me, I'll give you the entire world. And Jesus said no. And the idea that you would trade in everything for a couple of extra bucks, even though they're basically printed and borrowed these days, is kind of ridiculous. All right, let's get to the callers. Nehru.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm audible.
Yeah, go ahead.
I would like to ask Aryan presuppositional apologetic.
Sorry, you are asking me if I am a presuppositional apologetic?
Yes.
How pretentious are you? So, you know, we're talking to a general audience, right?
No, no. Why I asked you this question was because I've been
That's not how we have the conversation. I asked you a question, which means you either have to answer it or you can choose not to answer it, but you can't ignore it. Do you know that we're talking to a general audience on this platform? Okay. So of the general audience, how many people do you think understand presuppositional apologetics?
I would say not many.
So why would you not explain what you're talking about or put it in terms that the general population can understand? I'm just curious. Maybe there's a good reason, but I'm a little curious about that.
I'm sorry. I thought, can I reinstate my point from the beginning, please?
No, because I would like you to answer my question.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I made a mistake. I'm sorry.
No, but that, and I appreciate that. You don't really have anything to apologize for, but you're still not answering my question.
I thought this was a more advanced philosophy place. I thought that these were usual people who dabbled in philosophy, hence they would understand it. That's why I thought that may be the case.
You made an assumption.
Yes.
Now, I'm not sure if you heard my speech. I think you came in once before to talk. So, was I talking in technical, philosophical terms when I was addressing my audience as a whole? And I'm not, it's not a big bad thing or anything. I'm just kind of trying to understand where you're coming from. Was I using technical language when talking about these issues with my audience as a whole?
No, you were not.
Ah, okay, good. So, you understood that as a philosopher, I speak in the sort of Socratic common tongue, right? I don't use or rarely use technical language as a whole. So you heard all of that. Have you listened to my show before?
No, this is the first time I'm coming here.
Okay, first time. Okay, so I got it. So in general, it's important when you are talking in a new group to have some sense of people's level of technical knowledge. Now, if you don't know that, or if there's evidence to the contrary, which is that I'm using, you know, as a philosopher, I was very, very influenced by the fact that Socrates never used the word epistemology or metaphysics or anything like that. He spoke in the common tongue because philosophy should be something that is useful and helpful to everyone. So when you come into a new conversation, this is just a basic sort of social skill thing that might be helpful to you. It's usually important to not make assumptions, but rather to ask if you don't know something for sure. So if I was addressing a group, let's say somebody said, I want you to address a group about Bitcoin, then I would need to first understand what kind of group am I addressing? Are they technical programmers who understand the blockchain at the finest level of detail? Are they bankers who have only worked in fiat currency or stocks or bonds or things like that? So I would need to know what kind of audience I was addressing. And again, this is just a little communications tip for you, and maybe it's helpful to other people, but it's important to find out the nature of the audience that you're addressing before diving straight into technical terms. So it's just a little tip. It's no problem that you started off this way. So please, sir, go ahead with your question. I'd love to chat more.
Okay, so I apologize for everyone. So what I basically meant was that usually in the arguments of theism, there's one particular argument that I've been struggling with for a long time, and that's basically when a certain group of apologetics, they ask me, how can you ground reason, truth, and logic?
Sorry, how can you call what? Reason, truth, and logic?
How can you ground it?
How can you ground reason, truth, and logic? Sorry, go ahead.
They usually ask me, as in, I'm an agnostic, so they basically ask me, how can you ground reason, truth, and logic? Without having a God, without having a creator, any argument that I make is basically invalid for the reason that I do not believe in a God. Hence, reason, truth, logic, and morals cannot be grounded. And so basically, we have this problem in philosophy that is that you cannot justify reasoning if reasoning is valid without using reasoning. But apparently, there's a group of people that have found a way around it. And they're a new form of apologetics. And I just wanted to ask you a philosophy question. How can I ground reason, truth, logic, and morality without necessarily having a creator or a God in mind?
Sure. Okay. I mean, these are very big categories. So, what is your definition of logic?
I think logic are necessary truths that coincide with reality.
Okay, got it. Now, does reality come to us through our senses or through God?
I think reality comes to us through our senses, although our senses are false to some level, but they come through our senses.
So when you say the senses are false, do you mean that they're limited or that they are innately incorrect?
They're limited.
They're limited. So it's not false. Right. Yeah, so if I say 2 and 2 make 4, that is an accurate statement, but that is not all the truths in mathematics. So it's not false. It's just limited. It's limited to that equation, 2 and 2 make 4. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Now, can you think of a law of logic that contradicts the nature of reality that comes to us through the evidence of the senses?
No, I cannot think of it at all.
Yeah, I think that doesn't make much sense, right? So if you think of the sort of three basic laws of logic out of Aristotle, they conform to that which is reality, right? So I've got a ball in my hand. The ball is the ball, which is A is A. If I've got two objects in my hand, they can't both be the same thing, and it has to be one of the ball has to either be the ball or something else. So all of the laws of logic really around consistency and uniformity and universality, they all are accurate descriptions of the nature of reality that comes in consistently through the evidence of the senses. And if you disagree with that, of course, we can talk about that further, but that would be my starting point.
Okay, I think I agree with your point here. I think this rebuttal is logical. But what about morality?
Oh, hang on. We've got a couple of other categories, right? You had logic, reason, truth, and morality, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, if logic is the abstract description of the properties of matter and energy, in other words, objects cannot self-contradict themselves, a cat can't be both a cat and a dog at the same time, and objects, at least at the sense level, objects cannot be in two places at the same time, which is why we have something in law called an alibi, right? If you're accused of killing some guy, but it turns out you were in an airplane the whole time, and the guy wasn't in the airplane, but on the ground, then you cannot rationally be prosecuted because you can't be in two places at the same time. And so the laws of logic are derived from the evidence of the senses. And the laws of logic are abstractions of the behavior of matter and energy, which is why our waking world has a lot of logic to it. In fact, it's exclusively logical unless you're brain damaged or hallucinating or something like that. However, our dreams are sort of wild and chaotic and confusing, and they transition, and you can fly, but then you can't, and you know the oceans turn into mountains, and the mountains turn into clouds, and all kinds of crazy stuff happens. And so there's no logic within dreams, because dreams are not empirical. Empirical being the evidence of reality that comes to us through the senses. So that's why I asked if we get our sense data, our knowledge about reality, from the senses or from God. So, if logic is derived from the evidence of the senses, which it is, and if reality comes to our brains through the senses, then God is not necessary to explain logic. In fact, God is an entirely self-contradictory concept. God has no more consistent logic to him than any object in dreams where a tennis ball turns into a bird, turns into a dolphin, and so on. And so God, of course, is a self-contradictory entity in that God is an effect without a cause. God is consciousness without a brain. God is immaterial but able to affect matter. That God is both all-knowing and all-powerful. In other words, God knows what's going to happen in the future, therefore he cannot change it. So you can't be both all-powerful and all-knowing. And so God is a self-contradictory entity. And therefore, saying that logic comes from God rather than from our senses is like saying the only true reality is in our dreams and all of our waking reality is a fantasy, which wouldn't make any sense at all. So given that God is self-contradictory, And given that reason comes to us through the evidence of the senses, saying that God is required for reason is false. Let me know if that makes sense to you.
Yeah, that did make sense to me a lot.
Okay, so then the question is around truth. So truth is the relationship between ideas in the mind and things in the world. So if I point at a cloud and say that's a cloud, that is a true statement because cloud represents an aggregation of dust and water vapor in the sky in lovely, pleasant puffiness or cirrus or, you know, stratospheric stuff. So if I point at a cloud and I say that is a cloud, that is a true statement because my concept is accurately describing what it is that I am pointing at. If I point at a cat and say, what a lovely kitty, that's great. If I point at a dolphin and say, what a lovely cat, I'm incorrect because dolphins have no fur, they have no claws, and they live in the ocean, which is kind of the opposite of cats, although I suppose both. If I say to a dolphin and a cat, they're both mammals, well, sure. You know, they are warm-blooded, they give birth to live young, they provide milk for the young, and so on. So truth is when ideas in the mind accurately match things in the world. Can we agree on that as a whole? Now, where is God needed for that process?
So how they usually push back is that they say any form of reason or truth or logic cannot be grounded without God. If it's without God, then it means there's not an objective standard to it, hence it's false. And they basically, in a syllogism, it goes like, if there's reason, truth, and logic, they're infallible and they're true for all times, then we need an all-knowing, all-powerful being who has created them. And because X equals Y, and hence Y is true. I think I made a mistake on the syllogism. But yeah,
could you just take another run at that and just go a little bit slower, if you don't mind?
Okay, let me rephrase it better. So basically how they push back on this is, wait a minute.
I think I maybe understand. If you're saying all truths are eternal and only God is eternal, therefore God must be the source of all truths?
Yes.
Is it something like that?
Yes, it is something like that. Cornelius Van Til says that basically logic, Cornelius Van Til is a man, he says that logic, morality, reason, science only makes sense.
Okay, you've got to slow down. Your accent is quite thick and you kind of push your words together. So if you could just slow down a little to... as an indulgence to me, I would appreciate it. Go ahead.
Okay. So there was this guy who was named Cornelius Van Til. He basically says that logic, morality, reason, and science only make sense if God exists. It says without God himself, rational thought would be impossible. So in the simplified structure, what I would say is that humans use logic, they use morality, they use uniform laws of nature, and they use reason. And all these things that humans use, they are universal, they are immaterial, they are unchanging. Either materialism nor atheism cannot fully explain them. Therefore, a transcendent mind, God, is required as foundation for logic, morality, reason, and uniform laws of nature. For example, when someone argues that this is illogical, they're assuming that the universal laws of logic exist. But what we usually ask here is, why do universal laws of logic exist at all? Why should the universe be rationally understandable? And they say that the Christian worldview or the tag worldview explains this because the universe was created by a rational God. And basically the view by which we explain this is impossibility of the contrary, meaning without a God, knowledge and reasoning become impossible.
Okay, so if I understand this correctly, rather than looking at the evidence of the senses and the concepts that are derived or extrapolated from the evidence of the senses, which is if I let go of a ball, it falls to the ground, and therefore gravity exists, and gravity is universal, and the Earth falls around the Sun, and the Sun falls around the solar system, and the Moon falls around the Earth, and a little bit the Sun. So, rather than saying we can get universal truths by extrapolating from the evidence of the senses, the idea is that universal truth is not compared to the evidence of the senses or reason itself. Universal truth, absolute universal truth, is compared to the mind of God. That we cannot have absolute universal truth by comparing our ideas to the evidence of the senses. We can only have absolute universal truth if we compare our ideas to the mind of God. Is it something like that?
Yes. In a more shorter format for you to steelman it, I would say if the Christian God does not exist, then the preconditions of intelligible experience, reasoning, and knowledge cannot be accounted for. And because these preconditions do hold, the preconditions of intelligible experience, for reasoning, for knowledge, for laws of logic do hold, therefore the Christian God exists. That would be a more core syllogism of it.
Yeah, sorry, again, your words are running together quite a bit. I'm not sure why you're finding it hard to slow down, but it's a little hard to follow. Could you try it again, but slower?
Okay, let me slow down. So the core structure in a form I would give is, number one, if the Christian core does not exist, then the preconditions of intelligible experience, reasoning, and knowledge. Knowledge means the laws of logic, the uniformity of nature, objective morality, and the reliability of inductive method cannot be accounted for.
Hang on a sec here. So they're saying if the Christian God did not exist, then our capacity to reason is not accounted for, cannot be accounted for, and therefore because we could reason, the Christian God exists. Is that right?
Yes. Because the precondition...
Sorry, go ahead.
And proposition number two, that these preconditions do hold. We do have reasoning and logic and laws of logic and the uniformity of nature. We successfully reason, we do science, we make moral judgments, and we experience a coherent world. And because all these things exist, and they can only exist when the Christian God exists, therefore the Christian God does exist.
Okay, so because logic exists, the Christian God exists.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't follow the reasoning, and it's begging the question, which is, since the Christian God is not a rational entity, saying that an irrational or anti-rational entity is proof of logic is so ass backwards, it's hard to even fathom. So, to say that logic exists is not even a valid syllogism, because we have to then ask ourselves what is meant by the word exists or existence. And I know this sounds kind of abstract, but it's very real. So what I mean by that is, if we say that an object exists, we have to say what is its relationship to matter and energy. So if I say that if they have two coconuts on a table in front of me, and I say two coconuts exist, does the number two exist in the same way that the two coconuts do? Nope. And if you came to me and you said, I want to buy two coconuts from you, Steph, for $2, and I said, I took your $2, and then I just waved my hand at you and said, I'm transferring the concept of the number two, would you be satisfied? You would say, no, I want the actual coconuts because I want to break them open and eat the flesh and drink the milk and so on. And so the number two does not exist in the way that the two coconuts do. It's not tangible, it's not material. And of course, if I give you a coconut or I sell you a coconut, let's say I sell you two coconuts, then you have two coconuts and I no longer have two coconuts, because the physical material has passed along. If I train my daughter on the number two, I have not lost the number two. It has been reproduced in her mind. Like when I taught her the word for apple, I myself did not lose the word apple. I did not stop being able to use the word apple. When a teacher trains a student, the student gains knowledge, but the teacher does not lose knowledge. Where if a student is cold in the classroom and a teacher gives the student the jacket, then the student, at least for the time period of the classroom, has use of the jacket while the teacher does not. Physical objects are transferred and lost in the transfer to the ownership of the originator. So if I give you two coconuts, you have two coconuts, I don't have those two coconuts. And so the question of existence is material. Material things exist. Concepts are valid or not valid, but they do not exist outside the mind. So the two coconuts exist outside the mind. However, the concepts are valid or not valid. If you have four mangoes and I say those are two coconuts, then my concepts are invalid because it is neither two, it's four, neither is it a coconut, they are mangoes. So if I point at two, four mangoes and say those are two coconuts, I'm wrong on two counts. See how it's all coming together. So existence cannot just be a relationship. Existence is that which has material form or effects, because gravity doesn't exist in an objective way. You can't measure it in particles or so on, but it exists as a relationship between matter, that mass attracts mass. And so material things and energy exist, but concepts do not exist. They are valid or invalid. They are true or false, depending upon their relationship to objective reality. So again, if there are four mangoes and I say those are two coconuts, my statement is false. It is not false relative to God. It is false relative to objective reality, as through the evidence of the senses. Now, if I look at four mangoes and I say, those are four mangoes, that's a correct statement. If I say, those are four mangoes and two coconuts at the same time, is the statement true or false without any further examination? In other words, do you need to look at the mangoes to find out that they are both four mangoes and two coconuts at the same time? Do you need to do that?
No, I do not.
No, of course not, right? Because it cannot be that in this little bowl or basket or on this table, there are only four mangoes and only two coconuts at the same time. And so self-contradictory concepts, such as objects being both four mangoes and two coconuts at the same time, self-contradictory concepts are invalid, and they are invalid without the need for further examination. So then the question is God a self-contradictory concept? Well, of course it is. Because we cannot say that something exists and is utterly immaterial and has zero effects on the world, right? So if I were to take you to a plot of land and say, it's just an empty plot of land, and I were to say, I want you to buy the house on this land for $1 million, what would you say to me?
Well, I would say that's false and I cannot do that.
Right, because there's no house, right? You can walk around. It's not an invisible house, some Billy Joel house, right? You just walk through it, and I say, no. The house exists, and it is immaterial. It's a real house, and it's immaterial. Would that make any sense?
No.
So how would you know there's no house on the land?
Well, through my perception.
Yeah. You would look at it and you'd say, there's no house. And if I say, no, it's a very cunning house that you can't see. And, you know, let's say you believe me and you went up and I said, well, where's the door? And I say, here's the door. And your hand just goes through and, right. And then you take an infrared camera and there's no heat signature and so on. Like at some point, the house cannot be said to exist if there is absolutely no material evidence for the house. Does that make sense?
No.
Okay. So what is the material empirical evidence for the existence of God?
Well, the usual pushback by them is that for any reasoning that you have made throughout this to even make sense, first of all, would have to presuppose the God and the Christian God. Because let me give my argument for this. Number one, laws of logic, universality, immutability, abstract nature. There are certain laws like non-contradiction, laws like identity and the excluded middle. They're not physical. They exist, not invented by human minds. because they're not contingent, they're eternal and universal. They apply universally and necessarily independent of brains or cultures or regions. And they're not contingent on the materialism of the universe or the material universe. A purely material or either evolutionary chance-based worldview. How can contingent matter and why would contingent matter produce invariant and abstract laws? Why trust our evolved minds to reliably apply them rather than just survivability heuristics? And atheists can use logic. They do use logic. But to account for that logic in itself needs the existence of a God. Because the Christian God is an eternal, a rational, a personal triune mind. It's unity and diversity into one being. Crowns logic, and the reason how we can crown logic to God is because he crowns logic as a reflection of his consistent and his truthful nature. Example, God cannot deny himself because that's inconsistent with his truthful nature. Logic is not above God, but expressive of God's being.
That's all very nice sequence of syllables, but it doesn't answer the question, which is this. Non-existence is defined by the absence of material evidence of matter or energy. So we can't say gravity doesn't exist because we feel it and we measure it everywhere across the universe. And life, in fact, could never have existed if gravity was not constant. So the fact that we exist means that we know that physical laws are immutable and universal, because if they weren't immutable and universal, then we couldn't have had 4 billion years of life and we couldn't have a stable universe of 14 billion years or whatever the latest calculation is. So if non-existence means the absence of rational consistency and empirical evidence, then saying God exists because we have logic and empiricism, when God is the opposite of logic and empiricism, is called begging the question. So the question goes something like this, in my view, and I think it's a pretty obviously consistent view. So we don't ask whether God exists at all. That's a red herring. Any more than I would say, does this piece of bread exist? I mean, that's too specific a question. We create a category of that which exists, that which could exist, and that which cannot exist. So that which exists is stuff that we've seen and processed and we know about, the world around us, other people, the sky, the moon, these all exist, and we know that they exist. Now, there are things which could exist. So, for instance, could there be flying horses or something like flying horses somewhere in the universe? Well, sure. I mean, a flying horse is not innately self-contradictory. And therefore, we cannot with a certainty say that there are nothing that approximates a flying horse. It wouldn't be exactly like an Earth horse because it would be on some different planet or something like that. So we cannot with a certainty say there's no such thing as something like a flying horse in the universe, or something like not a carbon-based life form, but a silicon-based life form. We can't say that. And we'll never be able to say that, because we could scan the whole universe, but it would take us, billions of years to scan the universe, and by that time, it may have emerged in some planet we've left behind in our search. So there is that which exists, and we know that which could exist, because it's not self-contradictory, and that which cannot exist, and what cannot exist are self-contradictory entities. So I cannot say for sure that something like a flying horse does not exist anywhere in the universe. Maybe it does. It's not a self-contradictory entity. However, I can without a doubt say that there's no such thing as a square circle anywhere in the universe, because a square circle is a self-contradictory entity. If it is a circle, it is not a square. If it is a square, it is not a circle. So a square circle cannot exist anywhere in the universe. Self-contradictory entities cannot exist. So there's things we know that exist. There's three categories, right? Things we know and can prove exist, like Mars. We see it. We've been there. We know it exists. It's not self-contradictory entity. And there are things which could exist in that they are not self-contradictory entities, but we have no proof that they exist. And there are things which we know cannot exist because they are self-contradictory. So I don't know how many planets go around the planet, the star or the sun Betelgeuse. I don't know how many planets. I don't know if anyone does. I certainly don't know. And so if somebody would say to you, is it possible that there are planets around Betelgeuse? I'd say, well, I suppose, yeah. I mean, it seems possible. I don't think it's a supernova or anything like that. So it seems entirely possible that there are planets around Betelgeuse. Now, if somebody were to say to me, are there giant planets in the shape of a snowflake? I would say, no, because giant planets have a mass. And, you know, we know from Jupiter and Uranus and Neptune and so on, that giant planets tend to be spherical. And because we know that there is, unless it was somehow constructed, but I mean, a natural planet is not going to be in the shape of a big giant snowflake, because that's not how gravity operates. It would tend to collapse towards the center and create a ball. Or to go even more extreme, if somebody were to say to me, is there a planet around Betelgeuse that is both 93 million miles and 193 million miles away from the star, the star's surface? So it's the same planet, and it is both 93 and 193 million miles away from the surface of the sun. Would that be something that I would consider to be possibly true? Sorry, that's a question for you.
Could I repeat the question, please?
Sorry, when did you stop listening?
Just the last question. I was listening to it, and then you suddenly asked me the question. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah, if you could listen, that would be great, because I'm putting a lot of work in here to try and explain things. And if it's important enough for you to call in, I would appreciate that you listen. So if somebody were to say to me, or somebody were to say to you, do you think it's possible that there is a planet orbiting Betelgeuse that is both 93 million miles and 193 million miles away from the surface of the sun at the same time?
No, I would not.
Right, because it's not possible, because an object can't be in two places at the same time, at least an object that impacts upon the evidence of the senses. So if we say, look, there are these categories of things that we know exist, and those require, of course, logical consistency, and they also require empirical evidence, then we know that they exist. Now, the second category of things that could exist are things that are within the realm of possibility. They conform to the laws of physics and nature and biology, and they are not self-contradictory in nature, therefore they could exist. And then there are things which defy the laws of physics, such as being in two places at the same time, and are self-contradictory either through that or through some other mechanism. And are we comfortable in saying that objects that defy the laws of physics or are self-contradictory in nature cannot exist? We're not comfortable saying that? Okay, I'm happy to hear the case about how things that defy the laws of physics or are self-contradictory in some other way can exist.
I think the issue that we're facing is that you misunderstood my question. My question initially was that an atheist or someone who does not apply the Thai worldview can use logic. It can use reasoning, but it cannot ground it. The reason that
No. You asked me to answer the question. So you can't just tell me I'm not answering the question, because I am answering the question. But you need to answer my question, which is, can a self-contradictory entity or something which defies the laws of physics, can it exist?
No.
Okay, good. So then we've got three categories of knowledge, things we know that exist, and those are logical consistency, consistency with the laws of nature, and empirical evidence. We know that they exist. There are things which are logically consistent, do not defy the laws of nature, physics, and biology, but we have no proof of them. They could exist. And then there are things which are self-contradictory or defy the laws of nature, for which, of course, there's no empirical evidence, and those things do not exist. So we have these three categories. So in which category does the concept of God fall?
In what concept does? I think it is a being that has to exist rather than can exist, or anything.
No, hang on. So that's begging the question. We can't say that something exists because it has to exist. That's begging the question, which means you're putting the answer at the beginning. In other words, if an investor were to say, how much money are you going to make next year? And I said, $10 million. And he said, well, how do you get that you're going to make $10 million? And I say, well, I have to. But it's not an answer, right? And so is there any empirical evidence for the existence of God? Can he show up in any avenue of the senses or any translation of things like infrared we can see on an infrared camera? So is there any empirical evidence for the existence of God?
No, there's not.
Okay. So then God is not in the first category of things that we know exists. God is either in the second category of things that could exist, or God is in the third category of things which cannot exist. Now, in order for God to exist, God would have to be, or potentially exist, which would be the deist position, which is, I don't know, maybe, maybe not. If God were to be in the second category, then God would have to conform to all the laws of nature and physics and reason, but we have no certain proof of him yet, like something that's like a flying horse on another planet. So does God fall into the second category in that God is subject to all of the laws of physics and logic, but we have no empirical proof of him as yet?
Yes.
Okay. So God conforms to all of the laws of physics and logic.
Yes.
Okay. If you can explain to me, because it seems to me that God is consciousness without material form. God is an effect without a cause, and God cannot be all-knowing and all-powerful. So it seems to me that there's quite a lot of contradictions, but I'm certainly happy to have them ironed out.
No. God, the laws of logic do exist to him, because all the laws of logic to exist, there has to exist to God. And the reason that for the laws of logic to exist, there has to exist a God, because...
No. Sorry to interrupt. That's not the question. You said that God conforms to the laws of logic and physics.
Yes.
Okay. So how can you have something that exists and is immaterial? Because one of the definitions of existence is has material form. In other words, the house that I claim to sell you has to have some material form if you're going to accept it as a house that exists. So if God is consciousness, which is an effect of the brain, right? The consciousness is an effect of physical matter called the brain. So God has no material form. Is that correct?
For God's form, I would say that there's composition and parts. Matter is extended in space, divisible and composed of parts. But God is absolutely simple. Pure actuality with no parts, with no potentiality and no composition.
I thought you said pure charity. Do you mean pure materiality? I'm not following.
I meant that God is absolutely simple. He has pure actuality with no parts, no potentiality, and no composition. He has divine simplicity.
I don't know what any of that means, because you're not defining any of your terms. So does God have empirical material existence?
God does not have empirical or material existence.
Okay, fantastic. So earlier we said the house doesn't exist if it has no material empirical existence. The house, if I'm just selling you a plot of land, I claim there's a house on it. So the way we know the house doesn't exist is it has no material empirical existence. So if we say God exists and existence is material empirical evidence, then we're saying that which has no material empirical evidence is in the same category as that which has material empirical evidence. That's a contradiction. We can't say existence is material evidence and God exists, although God has the opposite property of existence, which is no material empirical evidence. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So saying God exists is a contradictory statement, because we're saying self-contradictory entities for which there's no material or empirical evidence that violate the laws of physics exist. But we've defined that which does not exist as exactly the nature and characteristics of God. So we're saying that which does not exist exists. And that is a contradictory statement. And that's how we know, one of the reasons we know, that there's no such thing as God.
But I think I can push back through transcendence. God is not a being within the universe alongside other material things. He is the creator who sustains all matters from beyond our critique of the material world. If God were material, if creation ex nihilo, out of nothing, becomes incoherent, reducing to a rearrangement of pre-existing stuff. But in my definition, God is not within this universe. He exists outside of the universe. And I had two questions before you could move forward. Do you believe in pure empiricism?
Hang on. You can't just make a counter argument and not let me rebut it, right? I just put forward a whole argument about three categories. And then you say, God is outside the universe, and then you want to just move on. That's not giving me a chance to rebut, right?
Hey, I just wanted two questions, please.
No. We're having a debate, which means that you make counter arguments, which is fine, and I counter those arguments. Isn't that how debate works where you're from?
Yeah, I think, yeah.
Okay, fantastic. So then let me rebut that argument. So if we say that God is outside the universe, do we have any way of perceiving or processing something that is outside the universe?
No.
Okay. So we are creating an imaginary realm where the opposite of existence is existence.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Like, there's no evidence for God, which means that he doesn't exist in the material realm. If we say, well, God exists outside the material realm, then we are creating an imaginary realm for which we have no proof, no evidence. And we're saying in that imaginary realm, the opposite of existence is existence, therefore God exists. That is not a valid argument. Because you can say that about anything, right? If I hand in a math test where I say 2 and 2 make 5, and the teacher says that's wrong, and I say, no, teacher, because in an imaginary realm that I've made up out of whole cloth, 2 and 2 makes 5. Would she say, yeah, okay, and then mark it correct?
No, they cannot.
No, of course not. If a friend of mine dies, and then somebody says, I'd like you to plan the funeral, and I say, I'm not going to plan the funeral because in an imaginary world I just made up, he's still alive. Would people accept that as a valid possibility and say that that's even more true than him being dead?
No.
So it's not a question of God. It's a question of error. There is no rational universe or no rational mind in which you can make up an imaginary fantasy realm wherein the opposite of truth is just magically willed to be truth and then think that you've proven anything. Because you could do that about anything. If I don't pay my taxes, I do pay my taxes, but if I didn't, and the government says, you didn't pay your taxes, can I say, no, in an imaginary realm I just made up, I did pay my taxes, and therefore you should stop phoning me, will they accept that?
No.
Okay, if you commit a terrible murder that's caught on video, and there's 10 eyewitnesses, and you're caught with the smoking gun in your hand, and your defense is, in another realm, I did the opposite of murder. I actually healed him. Would that cause you to not get punished?
No.
So making up an imaginary realm, for which there's no evidence, of course, and saying, in that imaginary made-up realm, the opposite of existence is existence, therefore God exists, is not even a child's argument. And I'm not calling you a child. I'm just saying that that argument is very childish. Now, the other, of course, perspective is that we only know of God's existence because God interferes with the material realm. I mean, in Christianity, of course, God gives commandments to Adam and Eve. God manifests himself. He walks around the garden. He punishes them. He makes floods. He talks to people. There's burning bushes. There's stone tablets. There is all kinds of miracles. He causes a child to be born of a virgin and then gives that child, who is Jesus, magical powers and so on, right? And I'm not trying to diminish it. I'm just saying that God interferes in the material realm or manifests his will in the material realm. I mean, pretty continuously. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Okay, so if God exists outside the universe, but God interferes in the universe, then we should be able to detect that interference. In other words, since God is answering billions of people's prayers and giving people visions and insights and thoughts and perspectives and so on, then we should be able to detect the hand of God in continuous monitoring where we have effects without a cause. In other words, if there are constant miracles, then it should be very, very well recorded and available on scientific instruments to have effects without a cause. Because God, coming from outside the universe, is continually changing things within the universe, right?
No, he exists in a... For what we mean by realm, what I meant by cause realm was, I meant that the Christian God acts upon the material realm, but he does not exist in any realm. Because
no, I understand that. No, that's exactly what I'm saying. So God does not exist in the material realm, but God is constantly changing things or altering things in the material realm. Because you pray to God for good fortune or getting healed from sickness or for people you care about to do well. And so you are constantly asking God to change the outcome of purely physical processes, right?
Yes.
Okay. So therefore, since you have billions of people talking to a God who is perfectly willing to put his hands on the scale, to put his finger on the roulette wheel and so on, and get it to change, you have billions of people constantly asking God to interfere or to change the outcome of purely natural processes. And therefore, if God exists, we should have almost infinite evidence of effects without a cause. In other words, God is bringing his ineffable will or his invisible will into changing the behavior of matter and energy so that people get what they want. So if I am a witch doctor and I say, well, if you give me all this food, I will do a dance that will change the weather. Well, I mean, of course, the scientific explanation would be that's not really happening and so on, right? It's just coincidence and things like that. So if God exists outside the universe, we can't say anything about that because we've just made up a realm wherein the opposite of truth is truth and think we've proven something, which we haven't. We've just removed standards of proof. Could be in some other universe. Okay, whatever, right? Now, the purpose of religion, though, is that you pray to God for his interference in the actual natural world. In other words, if your child gets sick, you pray for God to heal your child. In other words, you are praying for God to interfere with the natural processes of the world. Now, since we have an almost infinite number of very sensitive scientific instruments, we should be able to see the hand of God everywhere because there should be countless examples of effects without a cause. Because God reaches from the other dimension and interferes in the natural processes or changes the natural processes. So there should be countless examples of the behavior of matter that does not follow any natural pattern or law, but follows instead the prayers of people who are on their knees. And have we found any evidence of God interfering in the natural processes of matter and energy?
For example, I could say events like in the Bible, like parting of the Red Sea, the resurrection of Christ, or healing dead people. And
that's all hearsay. Sorry to interrupt, but that's all hearsay. We don't have any direct evidence of that. And of course, every religion says that they have their miracle workers and so on. It's a very common human phenomenon. That's why I said sort of scientific instruments. Like, do we have scientific instruments that can detect the rearrangement of matter and energy willed by God from outside the universe in response to people's prayers? Because that's what people are praying for. They are praying for God to change or interfere with the natural processes of the universe to their benefit. And so, given that we have exquisitely sensitive scientific instruments, if people pray for stuff, we should be able to see effects without a cause. Because God answers prayers and God says yes or no and so on, and people follow religion and give 10% of their money to the church because the church teaches them how to pray to God to change the behavior of matter and energy in their favor. And so we should, with all of our scientific instruments, be able to see God's finger pushing around matter and energy to the benefit of the petitioner. And in the modern world, is there any evidence of that?
No.
So God doesn't exist.
I would say that, first of all, let me make that the main argument I was making is that he does interfere into the world, but it is not mere meddling. You cannot assume that I say to God, oh, there's my book. Could you lift it and I hear a pet?
Okay, bro, you've got to slow down, because not only do you run all of your words together and you have an accent, you also have a bit of a wobble in your voice, so it's really hard to follow. I mean, we can have the conversation. I'll just ask one more time. Like, you've got to be considerate to me and to the audience. You know, when I'm speaking with someone who doesn't understand English that well, I slow down and I articulate. Not you, but I have listeners who call in from, say, Eastern Europe or Indians or something else. So I have to make sure that I'm relatively slow and clear, and I try not to mumble and blend all my words together. So I don't know if it's just a politeness thing. Like, English is not your first language, and I respect the fact that you're talking in English about a complex subject. That's very impressive. But I don't know why I need to keep asking you to slow down and articulate.
Okay. So, according to the Christian worldview, there are two ways that God acts in the material realm. There is general providences, continuous sustenance, and then there is special providences and miracles. Of course, special providences and miracles have no empirical evidence. All things in the Bible, you could say that's yes, and I would agree. But I would say that the way, first of all, God is an impartial spirit. He is not a material being. And the way he acts into the material realm is through general providence. God constantly upholds the existence, the order, and the laws of the material universe. The universe does not exist on its own. It is contingent and requires God to sustain it moment by moment. For example, in Colossians 1-7, in all him, all things hold together. In Hebrews 1-3, Christ upholds the universe by the word of his power. Natural laws, the uniformity of nature and the intelligibility of the physical world are grounded in God's consistent rational will. This directly addresses, for example, I don't think you believe in pure materialism or pure empiricism, do you?
Well, again, we're sort of back to the beginning of the conversation where you need to define your terms. What do you mean by pure materialism?
That everything's matter and they're not say exist. Everything's matter.
Yeah, everything is matter and energy. Everything is matter, energy, and void. Absolutely everything. You, me, everything.
Okay, so do you know the usual pushbacks that people make on materialism?
Sure, I mean, go ahead.
I would say that I could give an pushback from objective morality and meaning. If everything reduces to blind physical processes, yet humans experience morality as blinding and objective, materialism often collapses into relativism. That can ground why something is truly wrong beyond pure physical processes, as it is bad or reduces fitness. So from an objective morality perspective, I think it's wrong.
I'm sorry, are you reading or saying?
I'm saying.
Okay. Yeah, listen, I it's a long conversation. I don't want to exhaust the audience. So I have a whole proof of secular ethics called Universally Preferable Behavior, a rational proof of secular ethics. So, you know, we've done reality, we've done truth, we've done religion, we've done God, we've done matter and energy and logic. We've taken off a whole lot. I'm not going to dive into secular ethics. I've done it a million times before, but there is a proof of rational ethics. And so saying that God has to will for gravity to exist is not true. This is Occam's razor, right? That entities should not be unnecessarily multiplied. So gravity is a valid force, of course. It's a very empirical force in the universe. And of course, if there was no gravity, we wouldn't exist, because we need gravity in order to have things stay on the planet and for us to have an atmosphere and so on. So gravity is valid. And saying that God is needed to enforce gravity is not valid, because you are multiplying unnecessary entities with no proof. So if I said, I am held on this planet by 10,000 invisible fairies pushing me down, people would ask for proof or evidence of that, right?
Yes.
And if I couldn't provide any proof, then people would say, Well, we have gravity. It's a property of matter. We can observe it. I mean, we can't say the why of gravity because the universe is not why. Human beings are why, but the universe is. And so we have gravity as a universal property of matter, saying that gravity exists because God wills it on a continual basis is creating explanations for which there is no proof and evidence, which rely upon a self-contradictory entity that exists in some other dimension where the opposite of truth is the truth and the opposite of existence is existence. That is not an answer. That's a kind of craziness, if that makes sense. Not that you're crazy, but the argument is crazy, which is to say, some incomprehensible being that is the opposite of existence has to will gravity for gravity to exist. That's okay. Like saying that the reason I breathe is because invisible fairies are rowing in the back of my throat. Like, we don't need that explanation. Sorry, go ahead.
No, the universe was contingent and God built upon it. And if you have a whole view of secular rational ethics, I don't think we should go into it. But I would say that another hard do you know the hard problem of consciousness that refutes pure materialism?
Well, hang on. So I'm not, you're basically just firing a bunch of questions at me. So the purpose of debate is, I think, to try and change each other's minds, right?
Yes.
So just out of curiosity, have I changed your mind on anything over the last hour and a half?
I think you have.
Okay, good. What have I changed your mind on?
I don't think you've changed my mind, but I think you've given me some great new insights about perception and reality and how we see stuff. That's very helpful.
Okay, so what insights have changed your mind or can change your thinking?
When you're talking about logic as things that necessarily make sense of the world and things like long contradiction that exist, I think the conversation was very fruitful. I liked it.
Okay, yeah, just in general, I'm working very hard here to try and get things across to you and to the audience. I'm also doing it for free with no ads. And if I'm giving you helpful things, just continuing to fire questions at me makes me feel like a little bit of a slave or you're sort of coolie or it's like I've got to answer you or whatever it is, right? So some appreciation. Again, this is just a little social grace, politeness and nicety, like thank you, those are great answers, or they're very interesting answers, I have another question, as opposed to just giving me a conveyor belt of new questions with no sense as to whether I've provided anything of value to you so far. It demotivates me to continue the conversation, if that makes sense.
Yes, I'm sorry, you were great for the conversation. My mind is working really hard to work with you, and I've enjoyed the conversation so far. You're a wonderful person, and I'm very thankful to you for talking to me.
Okay, yeah, because if we're going to talk about politeness and ethics and virtue, it would be nice to see a little bit more display. But anyway, I can do one more question if you want.
Yeah, sure. So, please. Thank you very much for taking up my question. Another objection I would give to pure materialism would be the hard problem of consciousness. Easy problems of consciousness involve explaining functions, for example, perception, memory, attention, behavior. These can, in principle, be described via brain processes and that we see in textbooks. The hard problem is explaining why any physical processes give rise to subjective experience at all. For example, I could say that what it is like seeing a color that's green? What is it like feeling pain? What is it like tasting chocolate? What is it like talking to a person? What is the first time that you kissed your girlfriend? So I could say that no amount of details about neuron firing or synapses or brain waves and stuff could explain why information processing in our brain entails that we have subjective experience out of objective stuff. So there's an explanatory gap between objective physical description of stuff. For example, someone kissing his girlfriend for the first time, someone feeling great, someone feeling not so great. Even though the objective physical reality was the same, there were subjective differences. And so basically what materialism says is that re-engineering matter should only produce more matter and functions, not in a light of awareness or anything beyond matter. Yet consciousness, of course, exists undeniably. We're having this conversation because of it. This suggests that consciousness is not reducible in physical in the way materialism requires. alternative, like the alternatives that you could go for. So if you could please answer this argument as to why the hard problem of consciousness can be resolved in your worldview of pure materialism.
Okay, make me just help me understand if I've understood you correctly in your formulation. So the hard problem of consciousness is how we can have subjective preferences from objective stimuli. So some people like the color blue, some people dislike the color blue, some people like Chinese opera, other people don't like Chinese opera, some people like broccoli, other people don't like broccoli. Is that what you mean?
No, I meant that why objective processes give subjective experiences. For example, and that's why I wanted to ask, how can physical processes in general give subjective experiences to people?
What, isn't that what I just said? Sorry if I missed. How is that different from what I just said?
No, I wanted to reiterate my point, and yes, you're correct. I just wanted to ask how, if everything just matter, how can objective stuff give subjective interpretation of it?
Well, because the only reason we're able to develop a brain is because of preferences, subjective preferences. So is there any atom of your body that wants to live?
No.
No. And there's no atom of my body that wants to live. However, life is characterized in general by a desire to keep living, right?
Yes.
Okay. So the subjective preference to keep living is why we have a brain. Now, your ancestors, my ancestors, and so on, faced significant physical hardships. My ancestors faced winter, right? Because I'm from Northern Europe. Now, human beings prefer to live, and therefore, if planning for a long winter and laying up supplies, pickling things and making sure you have livestock to get milk and meat over the course of the winter, that serves survival. But it takes a certain amount of intelligence and planning to be able to achieve that. And farming, of course, takes a certain amount of intelligence and planning, as does trade and so on. So we have programmed into us by nature a desire to live, and therefore those of us who are best able to solve the problems of survival tend to reproduce the most. Do we tend to agree with that?
Yes.
So we only have a brain because of our subjective preference to live, which is not in any of our atoms, but is an emergent property of our entire consciousness and being. And the fact that we have intelligence to plan ahead makes us better able to survive. And so saying, well, how is it possible that objective processes can give us subjective experiences? Well, our entire brain, which is developed to the point where we can ask these questions, is conditioned by its ability to pursue the subjective preference of staying alive. In other words, evolution has selected the brains that have the strongest ability to pursue the subjective preference of living, and that is why we have subjective preferences from objective facts, because we couldn't have survived or flourished or reproduced if we didn't. It's sort of like saying, well, how is the eye so well designed for us as a species? Well, it's because those with better eyes tended to reproduce more. They could hunt better, they could detect prey, predators and prey better, and so on. And so how do we get subjective preferences from the human brain? My question would be, how could we possibly have developed the brain without the subjective preference of wanting to live and to flourish and to reproduce? There's not one atom or one cell in your body that wants to have sex and reproduce and raise children. But on the whole, for the most part, our sex drive plus our love of children has us reproduce and raise children. So materialism is incomprehensible without emergent properties, right? So there's no atom in your body that is alive. There's no atom in my body that is alive. However, when the atoms aggregate into cells and organs and the whole body, we have an emergent property called life. And so there's no individual atom, or even neuron, I suppose, in your brain that is able to experience or generate subjective experiences, but there is an emergent property in the brain called a subjective experience, which is necessary for the brain to evolve and to thrive and survive. And so materialism, if you only look at atoms, then human life, desires, preferences, and so on are incomprehensible. So there is no atom in your body that can give birth to another atom. There's no atom in your body that can inseminate an egg. But if you put the atoms together as sperm and you have a hospitable human female body, then you can give birth to a child. So if you reduce matter to mere atoms, which of course in its essence it is, and you remove emergent properties, which is particular aggregations of atoms, have characteristics that are greater than the sum of their parts. So none of my atoms are alive, but I have life. Not any one of my single atoms can think, but I can think. Not any one of my atoms can speak, but together we have the power of thought and of speech. So the key to understanding materialism is, and I'm sure you do, I'm just sort of reminding everyone, is to understand the realities of emergent properties. Emergent property called consciousness, which is an effect of the brain. So I hope that answers the question as to how the human brain can have subjective experiences from objective stimuli.
Okay. So I would like to say that this falls short for a reason, that there are easy problems of consciousness and then there are hard problems of consciousness. I love the explanation. It was a very interesting explanation, but they explained the easy problems such as reportability, attention, behavioral motivation, discrimination, a will to live, a will to reproduce, hypercamia, etc., etc., that we distinguish from the hard problems. Evolution basically subjects
hang on, hang on, or, hang on, hang on, hang on. So at the beginning of the conversation, I restated, or to make sure that I understood, and I said, you know, about the broccoli and some people like different colors and so on. And I asked you if that was the problem that we were trying to solve. And you said yes, right?
I think I took a misstep. I'm really sorry.
Hang on. I'm just talking about the reality of the cause, because I'm an empiricist, right? So if you ask me a problem, and then I restate it back to you, and we agree on the definition of the problem that is trying to be solved, and then I work very hard to solve that problem, does it then make sense to then say, the problem that we both agreed on that you did answer has now no longer or is not being answered by you? Because you were asking, how can we have subjective experiences from objective stimuli? And I gave some examples and we went back and forth and we agreed that those were the correct examples, or at least reasonable examples of the problem. And then I worked to solve that problem and gave you sort of the answers as to why. So then if we both agreed on the definition of the problem, and then I worked hard to answer the problem, then saying I didn't answer the problem without proof is not something that I'm going to take very seriously.
Okay.
Because if I didn't answer the problem, it's either because I misunderstood the question, which we had already gone through. I mean, I'm pretty careful about how I converse and how I debate. So if I didn't answer the question, in what way did I not answer the question? Because I certainly did answer how the brain is able to have subjective stimuli from subjective experiences from objective stimuli, in that the basic driver of life is the subjective preference for life itself. And so the brain has adapted based upon the subjective preference for life, based upon the objective requirements for life. So I think that I answered that. So you can't just tell me I didn't answer it as if I didn't. You actually have to tell me where I'm deficient.
Okay, so basically our argument centered on the utility of these mechanisms and not the emergence of subjectivity in itself. That's what I meant.
So not the emergence of subjectivity. But all animals survive because they wish to survive. The rabbit does not want to be eaten. The fox wants to eat the rabbit, right? So all life, yes. Can we agree that all life is based upon or has survived and reproduced based upon the subjective preference which exists in none of the atoms for life, survival, and reproduction? Is that fair to say?
That's very fair to say.
Okay, so all consciousness emerges from subjective preferences.
You could all consciousness exists.
Emerges from. In other words, if our ancestors had not preferred to live, we would not be here.
No, but the main question is, I get why there's a utility. I get why there's natural selection. Why do I want to reproduce? I get that if I don't reproduce, my life goes off. But it was mainly about the emergence of subjectivity. There's an extreme and
sorry,
extreme
the emergence
utility.
Of what? Hang on, slow down again. The emergence of what?
Subjectivity to objective things.
Right. So do you not understand that the preference of life is a subjective response to objective things like the requirements of food and shelter and reproduction?
It has a great utility. Subjectivity has a great utility. I'm not denying that. I'm just asking that your evolution does explain the utility of the mechanisms. It does not tell us why does objective stuff get us subjective. I could explain this with a thought problem.
No, please. But this is exactly the same as asking why do fish have gills? Because that's how they survive. So why do human beings have subjective responses to objective stimuli? Because that's how we survive.
Yes, I guess
that's how we reproduce.
Utility,
so help me understand what I'm not answering.
You're not answering why is there an emergence of subjectivity. I could give a thought experiment and you understand it way better, please.
Sure.
You could imagine, for example, philosophical zombies, creatures with identical physical brains, behaviors, and evolutionary history that performs all the same functions without any inner experience. If zombies are conceivable...
Okay, hang on. Hang on. I need to understand what you're talking about. So, are you saying that if we imagine human zombies with no inner preferences or desires?
Without any inexperience.
Sorry, without any inexperience? I don't know what that means.
Without any inner experience.
Oh, sorry, inner experience. Sorry about that. Okay, so you have consciousness without consciousness. Is that right?
No.
Because consciousness has a lot of inner experiences, right?
Yes. Wait a minute. What I meant by that was that they can behave, they can do all the functions, but they do not have any inner experience. They do not have any subjective preferences or experiences. That's what I meant.
Well, but they never would have evolved. They never would be alive.
Yeah,
because without the subjective
that.
Experience to survive and reproduce, the subjective preference to survive and reproduce, these zombies would not exist. So you're asking for something that's the opposite of why consciousness exists, which is if consciousness had no preferences, then it would not survive. It wouldn't last for a couple of days even, because if it didn't have any preferences to drink when it was thirsty, you'd get dehydrated and die in about 3 days. So these zombies could not exist. So listen, I don't mind theoreticals, but theoreticals, it's sort of like saying, well, Steph, I'm going to oppose your theory of gravity by creating a theoretical where there's no such thing as gravity. It's like, but there is gravity. So, sorry, go ahead.
Please. What I meant is in the Orthodox Christian and the Christian worldview, I was giving you the whole thought problem and your problem is a good rebuttal. But it usually would not have arisen if I had completed the whole of the problem. So can I again present my problem for what pure materialism is false and a Christian God exists?
Sorry. What's happening to the zombies? I don't think it's a valid rebuttal to say that if I say consciousness is based on subjective desires and you say, well, my rebuttal is to imagine a consciousness without subjective desires, that's not a valid argument, right?
Well, I could complete the argument and then we could rebut it as an atheist.
Well, but your argument is a complete straw man. Because if I say consciousness results from subjective preferences to survive and reproduce, and then you say, well, I can imagine a consciousness without any subjective desires, that is not a rebuttal.
Again, so basically
that is just making up
is...
a complete straw man that could never possibly exist and saying that that's a rebuttal to my argument, because those zombies would never evolve, they would never exist, and they would last about 3 days before dying of dehydration. So they would not be part of the 4 billion year march of life.
So the reason why I said to listen to my whole argument was because this would be covered in the same exact next line.
Okay, so, okay, fine. Finish the argument. We've got zombies with consciousness that's the opposite of consciousness. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so my argument for why pure materialism is false a Christian God exists and the transcendental argument is, and why you cannot give an evolutionary subjective pushback to, is that, for example, you can imagine philosophical zombies, creation with identical physical pains, behaviors, and evolutionary history that perform all the same functions, right? So they do drink water.
Sorry, hang on.
Please.
Hang on. No, it's rude. You can't just slip stuff in. I've said that all life and consciousness relies upon subjective preferences. So you can't then just say, well, imagine life that has the opposite of that. That's not an argument. Because so, I thought you saying, imagine we just create zombies, and you said, but zombies that have evolved without preferences. But you can't have evolution without preferences, because all evolution is based upon the preference for survival and reproduction. So I can't let you waste everyone's time by creating a straw man, which is just creating some imaginary opposite universe where somehow human beings or creatures evolve and thrive without any preferences whatsoever. Those zombies would all die. They would never evolve. They would never have brains. They would never have any rationality or intellect or anything like that, because even the smallest organisms need to try and find a way to survive and reproduce and so on. So, I don't mind a straw man. Sorry, I don't mind an analogous argument, but you can't just take the opposite of my argument, construct a fantasy universe where the opposite exists, and then claim that that's a rebuttal.
I could tell you why they would all die. It doesn't land. I have an argument for that.
I'm sorry, I can't hear what you're saying.
I can tell you why the world won't die. I have an argument for that. Would you like to listen to it?
I still can't hear what you're saying. I can tell you what I don't know. What are you saying? But slow down.
I can give a rebuttal to that. Would you like to listen to it, please?
A rebuttal to what?
To your argument that those zombies would die.
So, creatures with no preference for survival would not experience thirst or hunger or any desire for self-protection, and they would have no desire to reproduce. So how could they evolve?
So what I'm saying is that I could give you the answer and then we could discuss on the basis of that answer. It is not too long.
No, just answer me the question. How could a creature with zero desire for survival or self-protection or food or water or anything like that, how could such a creature survive?
Again, would you want to listen to the critique? Because
I'd like you to answer the question. How could a creature with no preferences survive?
Okay, so the philosophical zombies or the P zombies, they do not lack all desires in the functional sense. They lack phenomenal desires, the subjective. You get that?
They lack phenomenal desires that are subjective?
They do not lack all desires. They lack phenomenal desires, the subjective, felt wanting. So I can tell you what is. There's functional desires, what evolution actually selects for, homeostatic drives, reinforcement learning circuits, etc., etc., etc. And why zombies could evolve without phenomenal desire, because there could be a gradual...
Sorry, what is a phenomenal desire?
How would I define a phenomenal desire?
Yeah. I mean, this is right back to the beginning. Is it you're talking to a general audience? So you can't just say zombies have desires, but not phenomenal desires, and then move on as if anybody knows what the hell you're talking about.
A phenomenal desire is a desire in terms of its subjective, what it's like character. For example, the felt experience of wanting something, wanting love, wanting to have a partner, that's a phenomenal desire. That's a subjective craving, longing, etc. That's a phenomenal desire.
Okay, is it different from hunger and thirst?
Yes.
Why?
Because functional desires can exist without wants. Mechanisms that defect, for example, through materialism, homeostatic drives. There's a mechanism that detects nutrient deficits and triggers a foraging behavior. This is universal in everyone. This can be described in terms of information processing, feedback loops, and causal chains. There's no subjective experience. There's no subjective view to wanting thirst. Everyone feels thirst. Everyone feels thirsty. This is a functional desire, not a phenomenal desire. And there's a reason why they could evolve without the phenomenal desire, because there can be a gradual mechanistic order. For example, we could start simple.
Why do we need zombies? You mean like apes that don't have big abstract longings for truth and meaning and so on, right?
I think, I'm not sure too much, I've not read too much about apes, but I do think they have phenomenal desires for love, etc., etc.
Okay, so apes' desire for love is categorized with humans' desire for meaning or a rabbit's desire to reproduce. So again, now I don't know what you mean by phenomenal versus non-phenomenal desires. Because the sexual drive is equal to the drive and sometimes greater than the drive for eating and drinking. And so if the desire for sexuality is now considered phenomenal and yet hunger and thirst or not, I now no longer understand the category.
Okay, so could I give an example to tell you what is the functional design?
Okay, like I'm just running out of patience with all of these examples. I just need a rational argument. Creating zombies with like potentially this or that preferences or desires that are like apes, but not like apes, and it's like love or sexuality, but it's not like food and hunger. That's just a bunch of nonsense. Honestly, like, no disrespect for you, but you can't answer the argument that the reason we have subjective responses to objective experiences is because that's how our brains evolve and that's how we, it's the only way we can survive. So that's how, now, as to how the mechanics of it work at the neuron level, nobody knows. And it's fine. We're a young species with a big brain and our brain is big enough to ask these questions, which means it's big and complex enough that it's going to be very hard to answer. And in the end, there will be no causal explanation to our brains because we possess free will. So I will remove from the conversation from you. I appreciate the conversation. It was very interesting, but you mumble mouth a lot. You run your words together. You introduce terms with no explanation, despite repeated requests for you to explain your terms. You accuse me of not answering the question, even though we both agreed on the question, and you can't tell me why I haven't answered the question. You just create analogies that are impossible to try and disprove my position. I consider that highly negative and manipulative. And this is often where things go with regards to religious topics, that you just run a gish gallop of endless objections and questions and oppositions and analogies, and none of the core or central questions are ever dealt with. So anyway, I really do appreciate everyone's time today. I found it fascinating. It's been a while. It's been quite a long while since I've discussed these topics. So I really do appreciate everyone's thoughts and feedback on all of this. And I send you lots of love if you could help me out. Of course, freedomain.com/donate. Freedomain.com/donate. I would really, really appreciate it. I'm sorry for the callers we didn't get to, but we will get to you soon. And take care, my friends. Bye-bye.